All right, I think we should be good to go.
Welcome to the last class of this semester for this class. If you have other classes, don't not go to them because I said this was the last class. You may have other places you need to go. In my case, it may be the last time I'm wearing a tie until September. I'm very pleased about that. It's the swallowing thing. It's the only part that really gets to me. So what I'd like to do today, I've made it through all the material as of the end of class last time. So what I was going to do is do a lightning fast survey of what it is we covered, just to get it all in one place at one time, and remind you of all the ground that we've been across. Then I'd be happy to answer questions about the sample final. I have not yet gotten any questions from anybody about it. The only questions I've gotten so far have been about grading of things, which is important too, but I'm hoping that people spend some time on the sample final. So I saw the hand first, and then we'll go to you.
Are you guys set up the answers the way that you do with the sample?
I will, yes. I didn't want to do it before today for two reasons. One is because I wanted to make sure in my answers I hit the points that people are actually confused by. And the other one is I might end up changing the questions a little bit depending on the feedback that I get. So I want to... Yeah, I'm going to match it to that. But it'll be out by Friday. I'll have that all written up. Actually, Ari drafted it already, and then I edited it. So it might be ready to go, but I just want to make sure we're in good shape first. Yeah?
I have the same question.
Well done. Great minds. All right. Okay, then. All right, so this is my whirlwind tour. Here we go. Review, chapter 0 through 9. All right, so the preface, chapter 0, is called The Magic in the Stone. This is organized by the chapters in the book, again, in case you have forgotten that there's a book in this class. The main things that we saw in that chapter, in that the preface, are that computers are everywhere. They're creating all sorts of new capabilities, things that people couldn't do before are now possible, opening up all sorts of vistas. And that the key idea that tied all this together was not the computer, the device, but this idea of reduction. This idea that we can make very complicated things out of simpler pieces, which in turn can be made out of even simpler pieces until we get down to something that's really, really simple, basically a bit, 0 or 1, that is represented in some physical medium. To try to drive this idea home, or at least get you thinking about this idea, we ended up learning how to read barcodes, which is not quite, I don't think we ever got to the point where we could look at them in the store, you know, and know what the numbers were. But what we could do is realize that there's enough structure in the barcode numbers that if you took one of those numbers out, you could figure out what was missing based on the other numbers. If we had better eyes or tools that we could bring with us, we could have read the bars themselves. Then into chapter 1, which was called Nuts and Bolts, but it really should have been something like, you know, bits and bits. The idea of a bit is this distinction between zeroness and oneness, just left and right, up and down. It's just one distinction, and it's the simplest possible distinction that you could make, but what we've been learning over the course of the semester is that by sequencing these bits together, we can represent anything that we want. Pictures and colors and sounds and programs, anything that we want to represent, we can get down to the lowest level and represent it in terms of bits. In computers that you've dealt with and that I've dealt with, bits are actually represented as charges in silicon, high voltage and low voltage. But in fact, I showed some examples where you could represent a bit using dominoes falling or balls rolling down Lego tracks. And that's not the important part. The important part is that they represent this distinction and that we can work with them and combine them in various ways. So we started at that point to look at how we evaluate an expression using ands, ors, and nots. So a Boolean expression where each variable represents a bit, true or false, 0 and 1, and then we can combine them together in various ways using Boolean operators like and, or, and not. What does that turn out to be? Chapter 2 seems to have the same thing as chapter 1. All right, something's not right. What do you think? Which chapter name is wrong? Chapter 1 is Nuts and Bolts. Chapter 2 is Universal Building Blocks. This. Sadly, my editing, it didn't change it in the notes if you've downloaded them already. All right, so the idea of universal building blocks is that there's just a couple different things, a couple different ways that you can combine bits that then they themselves can be combined in many ways, and then you can cover all possible functions on bits. So universal logic gates can simulate ANDs, ORs, and NOTs, and vice versa, I guess, is the important thing. That if you have AND, OR, and NOT, you can simulate any other logic gate that you want. Gates can be defined in terms of simpler gates, back to this idea of reduction, and we ended up playing around with logical expressions and truth tables. This idea of if you've got a set of variables, look at all different ways that you can assign them to true and false, and what the, if those are inputs, then what is the output for each of those combinations? That's a truth table. We looked at some very simple logic gates and learned to recognize some simple functions of logic gates. One of the important things that we picked up at this point was how to represent numbers in binary. And we've played around with that skill quite a bit. In fact, we've looked at converting between binary and decimal in both directions. If you've got a binary sequence, what does it represent in decimal? If you have a number in decimal, how would you represent it in binary? We even looked at adding and negating numbers in binary and subtracting as well. We tried to put these ideas together to create a set of fundamental circuits that ultimately were important in constructing a CPU, or central processing unit. So this is all the circuitry in the computer that allows it to do all the different things that it does is all encoded in a set of logic blocks. And so I at least took you up to the point of here's how I would build one of those things out of the logic blocks that we talked about. You might not have understood exactly why this wire was here, this wire was there, and so forth, but at least I showed you there's no magic, right? There's just these combinations of things that we've already talked about, and when you wire them together in the right way, it can execute instructions and then start to act like a real computer. That had to be combined with this idea of memory that holds on to the data and the programs, and you address it in binary. And arithmetic circuits perform the actual mathematical calculations. Each clock cycle, each time it goes through, what it does is it executes one small instruction. It fetches an instruction from memory, it decodes it, it changes the data according to that instruction, and then it's done that cycle, and it goes and it does it again. And what a computer is doing is just recycling this idea over and over and over again, each time picking up whatever the next instruction is. Machine language programs themselves are just made out of bytes, made out of sequences of blocks of bits. And that everything that the computer does is actually made up of series of these small instructions. We then went up the next level and talked about programming, at which point we can now see kind of the whole hierarchy, the whole story about what a computer is. That application programs, things that you run, PowerPoint and Word and Outlook, all the different things you might run on a computer, are built in terms of sets of software libraries, which themselves are represented as programs in high-level languages, which themselves are executed by machine language programs, which themselves are constructed out of logic blocks, which are made out of basic logic gates, ANDs, ORs, and NOTs, which at the lowest level are just, you know, power going on and off, physical bits. So everything that's happening is all happening in all levels of this chain simultaneously. The idea of a subroutine lets us package up repeated operations, like making a square or singing the chorus of a song. Sets of instructions that we might want to reuse over and over again. Lets us use this idea of reduction at an even higher level. And so everybody wrote a song as a series of subroutines. We talked a little, I think I may have mentioned parameter, I don't think I did though, because Scratch doesn't let you make parameterized subroutines. The idea of a parameterized subroutine is that when you call the subroutine, you actually give it like a number. It's like, I don't just say do jumping jacks, I say do 7 jumping jacks. Like I can make the routine actually act differently depending on what it's told. But since Scratch didn't do it, we didn't end up spending a lot of time on it in this class. We may not have spent any time on it in this class. I did talk a little bit about this idea of a subroutine stack that keeps track of the program's place, and I showed you a Scratch program that was singing the song of Old MacDonald Had a Farm, and showed you how it was, during the chorus, a bunch of things were kind of on hold, and each time something finished, it would then pop up to the next level, the thing that it was in the middle of doing when it started that, and the subroutine stack unfolded like that. I talked a little bit about this idea that when people write computer programs, these computer programs can't be executed directly on the hardware of the computer. So what happens is there's two different ways that these high-level programs that people can write get turned into very low-level programs that computers can execute. One way is with a thing called a compiler. What a compiler does is it takes a program and then turns it into, like, takes all the big complicated statements and turns them into series of very small statements. A big block of small statements like that get actually executed directly on the computer. That's what a compiler does. The other idea is the idea of a translator. Instead of translating the program, the high-level program, there's a machine language program that acts on the source code, acts on the program that was written, and interprets it step by step. They end up basically doing the same thing, but often compiled programs run a bit faster, but compiled programs have to be compiled. Interpreted programs, as soon as you write them, they can start running. Scratch, I think, would be, you best think of that as an interpreted language. So you build your Scratch programs on the screen, and there's a program underneath of it that's actually figuring out how to execute those instructions. A compiled version of Scratch would be one where you build your Scratch program, and then you push a button, and then behind the scenes, a whole lot of analysis is done on your program, and it's turned into an executable that can run directly on the computer. So I've not seen a Scratch compiler, but one could imagine such a thing. We talked a little bit about expression trees as an example of this kind of analysis. Chapter 4 was about how universal are Turing machines. This is introducing the idea of computability, and the way that I tried to introduce this is by focusing on this notion of self-contradiction, since that was at the core of a lot of the results in this area. So the basic mathematical idea here is that if you make an assumption, and by making that assumption and then using regular logical reasoning, it leads you to a contradiction, something that just can't be, then your assumption must have been broken. And the various things that have taken this form are the Barber paradox in mathematical in set theory, Gödel's theorem, mathematical logic, Cantor's diagonalization, we talked about that as well, that we end up proving really interesting, deep results by saying, well, let's assume that such and such is true, and let's see where that leads us. Wait a second, something bad has happened. So the key idea, so the key way that this is used in a computer science context is this notion of the halting problem of computability. And what I explained is that, we'll make an assumption. Let's assume that we can write a program that can always detect whether any other program is going to go into an infinite loop. If such a program existed, we could create from that a program that simultaneously loops forever and doesn't loop forever. Which, of course, makes no sense. What went wrong? Our assumption that such a program exists is where things went wrong. You can't have a program that can tell whether any other program will halt or not halt. It can do it in some special cases, but if it could do it for all cases, that would lead to a contradiction. And so what we infer from this is there are programs, like the halting problem, there are problems, like the halting problem, that can't be solved with computer programs. There's no computer program that can guarantee solve this problem. And that was a revelation to a lot of people, including philosophers, that wait a second, what's going on here? This computation actually has limits. It's not just the case that, anything we can imagine, we could write a program for. No, in fact, there's things that we can imagine just fine that are logical impossibilities, and we can't write such programs. I don't think I talked about it in this chapter, actually, but I did talk about random numbers, ways of actually generating random numbers, how random numbers can be useful, and some things that you can do with random numbers, like if you have events that have certain probabilities, how many times do you have to repeat it before a certain thing happens? And the fundamental relationship was this on the third bullet there, that if some event has some probability p, on average it's going to take 1 over p, the reciprocal of p, tries before that thing happens on average. And 1 over p need not be an integer. So, if the probability is like a fifth that something's going to happen, you'd have to repeat 5 times on average, so that's an integer. But if the probability was like 2/3, the reciprocal of 2/3 is 3/2, 1.5. And that ends up being the average, the number of times that you have to do it before the event happens. So that was a skill we had, and there'd be a question on the final specifically of that form. There's also a question on the final about this, for what values is a given loop going to halt? So even though I'm telling you the halting problem is impossible, I'm going to ask you to solve it anyway for certain special cases. All right, chapter 5 got into the part of computer science that's most exciting for me, which is the idea of algorithms and heuristics, though I think I really only focused on algorithms. An algorithm is really just an approach to solving a problem. And what's neat about it, people have realized, is that different approaches can solve different problems more or less efficiently. And so the game, the fun intellectual exercise, ends up being, okay, I've got this problem. What's the best algorithm? What's an algorithm that I could apply to this that's going to go as quickly as any algorithm could possibly run? We talked about this in the context of sock matching because that's what Hillis did. I'm not sure that's a great example, but it is what it is. And there are a set of different algorithms you could use for sock matching, and some are better than others. We did also, I guess, I don't know if it was in this context or not, but we talked about counting the number of gates in a multi-level logic block. There's a question on the final about that. We also looked at, well, so when you're building algorithms, you build algorithms to solve specific problems. So we looked at a couple specific problems. One of them are, there's a set of them including decision problems on lists. Like I give you a list of numbers, can you answer the following question? How can you answer it quickly? And we talked about questions like, is X the median of this list? Or is the sum of all these numbers divisible by 5? Or is the product of all these numbers divisible by 5? So these are questions that you can answer, but there's faster and slower ways of finding the answer. And the faster ways are the ones that we really want. When we go to analyze, what does it mean for one algorithm to be faster or slower than another? We usually use running time, the number of statements that execute on the computer before the answer comes out. And to get this idea of asymptotic growth, how does the size of the input relate to the running time of the algorithm, we looked at singing generalizations of songs. So a song with n verses, how many syllables does that song have as a function of n? Number of syllables is a pain to figure out as a function of n. So we use big O notation and just very coarsely categorize these different algorithms or different songs into classes. And this actually lets us get the kind of answer that we need, but with a lot less work. The major classes of song growth rates that we talked about are these. This would be helpful if you haven't internalized this yet. This is a good slide to stare at. If a song has constant size verses, like each verse is the same size as every other verse, and you've got n of them, then the growth rate is linear, or O of n. On the other hand, if the verses get bigger as the song goes on, because each one has a number in it, and the numbers are getting bigger, then you get linear logarithmic, or n log n, big O of n log n. And in particular, what's happening here is you have n verses, and for each verse, you sing a number, and the numbers can be as big as the logarithm of n. So it's n times logarithm of n. N for the verses, and each verse has in it a number. On the other hand, you could also have a song where each verse is just as big as the previous verse, but there's a constant addition added to it. So songs like There's a Hole in the Bottom of the Sea, if you're familiar with that one, where each verse gets one line longer than the previous one. What happens there is, since the last verse has pieces of all the previous verses, there's n verses, and the last one could be as big, essentially, as n, you get n times n, or n squared, quadratic. Then the fourth class is, 1, 2, 3, 4, the fourth class is, if you have kind of a combination of both of these ideas, that in each verse of the song, you not only have to sing a number, but you have to sing all the previous numbers, now what happens is, each of the n verses can have n in it because you're repeating something n times, and it might have a number in it, log n, so you end up with n times log n, or n squared log n. So this is the kind of song like the 12 Days of Christmas, where by the 12th verse you're actually counting down from 12 all the way to 1. Now a common mistake that people make is forgetting that it's not thinking about n as being a really, really big number. If you think about n as being a small number like 12, then all the verses actually look about the same size. But if you think about n as being a huge number like a million, then to sing the number a million or a million minus 1 is a lot of syllables. And the number of syllables is actually the logarithm of the number. And so that's why we get this extra factor of log n. It's the really big verses, the number actually starts to take a significant amount of time to sing. So another thing that came up in the context of this chapter is this notion of distinguishing proper and improper uses of the word exponential. In particular, some people use it to mean it grows exponentially, which is the right way to use it, and some people use it just to mean big. And if you want to tell the difference between these two cases, the litmus test that you want, or I guess Littmann's test that you want to apply, is that if a sentence is talking about a trend, a growth, a change over time, then that's good. If it's just talking about 2 points, like it was this and now it's this, it can't be exponentially bigger. So that's if people use the word exponential in that setting, that's just wrong. There has to be at least 3 points before you can start making any claims about it being exponential. And even 3 doesn't really seem like a good one. Once we have these kind of notions of growth rate in our back pocket, we can apply them to the analysis of algorithms. And so we looked at analyzing sock sorters, we looked at analyzing sorting lists of numbers, we looked at analyzing the time to find something in a sorted list, and all these different problems ended up falling into one of these growth classes. I did mention briefly a really important concept that I will not have on the final, but it is a really important concept in computer science, which is this notion that there are some problems that as the size of the input gets bigger, no one's been able to come up with an algorithm that grows any slower than exponentially. So these problems seem to get really, really hard really fast. And it turns out people used reduction to show that they're really all related to each other, and they call that class the NP-complete problems. So these are problems that they're just tough nuts to crack. We have no way of solving them in less than exponential time. And if we could solve any one of them in less than exponential time, we could solve them all in less than exponential time. So it's like, we don't know, are they all hard, are they all easy? We can't figure out which way they fall. So this is a long-standing open problem in computer science. I know people know famous open problems like Fermat's Last Theorem, which I guess isn't open anymore. It was open when I was in college. There's Riemann hypothesis. There's a bunch of problems in mathematics that are really famous because people have stated the problem, but they've never been able to figure out the answer. And generations of mathematicians work on this problem and maybe make a little bit of progress, and a lot of it end up getting solved. So Fermat's Last Theorem has been solved in our mutual lifetimes, I think. The big question in computer science is, does P equal NP? That is to say, the problems that are NP-complete, can we solve them all in polynomial time, or can we solve none of them in polynomial time? Which way does it go? And this problem's been open since the 70s, and lots of really smart people have worked on it. We have a guy named Eric Allender, who's currently the chair in computer science, who has made some really nice contributions to the field's understanding of this question, but it's still not solved. All right, I talked about a bunch of algorithmic problems in the context of Google. Again, not because Google is something special or magical, but because it's very familiar. The same issues come up for lots of other computer science applications or web applications. The context that it came up first in the class is in terms of graph search. So Google builds a map of the web by visiting web pages it knows about and then looking at those pages for the addresses of other pages. So it's sort of spreading out, hopping from page to page, pulling down copies of everything to get the information it needs to serve web requests. So this idea of starting someplace in a network and spreading out by going to the neighbors of that one at a time is called graph search. And it can be used for lots of different things, but Google uses it to index the web. Sometimes they call this spidering because the web is a web and spiders walk on webs. There you go. All right, so we talked about some terminology in graphs, including graphs defined by nodes and links. We talked about what a source is, and a sink is, and a path, a cycle, a connected component, a tour in a graph, whether a graph is directed or underdirected, whether a graph is a tree. And we defined this notion of reachable. A node is reachable from some other node if there's a path. So X is reachable from Y if there's a path that would take you from Y following links to X. And so there's a question on the final specifically about what's reachable from what. We talked about another particular problem, sorting list of numbers, and both how to do it and why it's useful. So one of the reasons to do it is because once you have, if you have a list of numbers or a list of anything, if you have names of people in the university or courses that you might take or state capital, I mean, a list of anything, once it's ordered, you can do things like find out whether something's in the list or not much faster. We talked about 2 particular sorting algorithms, and I sang to you about them. One is selection sort, The idea of selection sort is that you repeatedly find and remove the smallest element of the list. So you have your list of numbers unsorted, search through it, find the smallest one, pull it out to put it in your sorted list, and then just keep repeating this. And it's n squared because each time looking through the list for the next smallest could be n, and you have to do it n times. N times n is n squared. I contrasted this with the idea of quicksort. What quicksort does is actually makes much more rapid progress towards sorting a list by splitting the list into big and small elements relative to some pivot. So you grab a random element of the list and you say, okay, who's smaller and bigger than this? Let's put the small ones over here and the big ones over here. Now we'll just concentrate on the small ones, sort them. Then we'll just concentrate on the big ones, sort them, and the whole thing's now sorted because you kind of pre-segregated the small from the big. Once you do this, you actually get an expected running time that is n times the logarithm of n. So instead of for each element in the list doing n work, you're doing just log n work. Log n comes up in another context, which is binary search. This idea that if you've got n different choices, and you want to whittle down the choices until you've got just one, and on each time you ask a question, you can split the list in half, the number of times that you need to do that before you get down to one is the logarithm of n. And so if you have, I don't know, I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 15, you might guess 7. You might guess a number that's in the middle. And then either you're right, or if you're wrong, you've got the 6 on one side and 6 on the other. Does that work? That would be if it was 13. Maybe you need to guess 8? No, I guess 7. I can try that. Anyway, the point is that if questions always split the set of possibilities into the yeses and the nos, and you always ask a question that splits things in half, then the number of times you can split in half before you get down to one is the number of questions that it will take, and that's exactly what the log of n is. All right, chapter 6 was called Memory, Information, and Secret Codes. Mostly, I talked about Huffman coding in this block. So there's different ways of taking things in the real world and representing them in terms of bits. Each different way of doing it is called an encoding. If you've got information that's represented one way, but you can actually change the encoding and make it so that it's represented in a shorter way, that's called compression. And compression turns out to be important for representing sound and representing pictures and video, and compression is happening all over the place to try to make the most use of the bits that we have available to us. If the compression doesn't throw away any information, it's the same information but represented with fewer bits, then that's called lossless compression. But on the other hand, sometimes you can throw some of the information away and like, well, there's two different shades of green, but we're going to represent them as the same, so that distinction is going to be lost. That's called lossy compression. And what you notice is now that more and more people have, more and more things are being broadcast in HD format, you need a lot of bits to specify all those pixels over the huge screen. So compression is turning out to be really important, and they're using lossy compression. And so image quality is actually suffering because we have HDTV now. I talked about Huffman coding as a particular way of using as few bits as possible to represent strings of characters. And in particular, what it does is it uses short sequences of bits to represent very common characters, since they're happening very often, and longer sequences of bits to represent very infrequent characters, because they'll have very little impact on the overall total number of bits. And so we actually went through the process of, here, I give you a string, what would a Huffman encoding be for the letters that are in that string to make it as small as possible? And we were able to go derive those encodings, encode strings in those encodings, and also take a series of bits and turn it back into what the letters would have to be given that encoding. Chapter 7 was called Speed, Parallel Computers, and it started off with this idea that Moore's Law says roughly computers double in speed every year and a half, but we're going to hit a fundamental limit in the next decade or so, and the only way around it is to make computers more powerful by putting more computers in a given space. But that means now having multiple computers working at the same problem at the same time. And so some problems can be sped up that way, and some can't. And others can, but only if you come up with clever algorithms. So there's a whole other field of algorithms that concentrates on parallel algorithms, algorithms that are going to run on groups of computers simultaneously. I pointed out that the kind of parallelism that turns out to be relatively easy to deal with is when you can turn it into a map and reduce idea, where you have a big set of data that you're going to work on, and you ship it out to lots of computers, and each of them works on a small piece, and then they send their stuff back to the original requester, pulling the answer together from that. If you can break your problem down that way, then you can make use of lots and lots of separate computers to speed things up. The example that I showed in class was this idea of, well, what if we were trying to do image processing, and we had one processor for each pixel in the image? What would it look like to make a program for that? What sort of things can we do with it? How do we make a green screen program? Chapter 8 is called, or was called, Computers That Learn and Adapt. I talked about the problem of learning classifiers, where you map feature vectors to yes or no. Is this a positive example or a negative example? And I mentioned an application where people were using these kind of machine learning techniques to recognize whether someone's likely to kill again. And maybe a more mundane sort of thing where people are using these ideas to recognize phonemes and therefore to do speech recognition. So if you have one of these phones or something where you can say people's names to it, a lot of times the recognizers for the different sounds are actually built up out of doing supervised machine learning, building classifiers. These classifiers can be created automatically or learned by analyzing a training set of examples. So it's not the case that a person actually has to decide, oh, a little more of this, a little bit of that. If you give these programs enough examples, they can actually tune themselves and find good answers. So this is a very powerful idea, and it kind of gets the engineer or the programmer out of the loop and to the position of actually collecting the information that's needed to create the application. I mentioned decision trees in particular because that's an easy enough one to understand, but I don't think I said very much about that. In the same context, I talked a bit about robotics and various situations in which infinite loops, like forever loops or while true loops, actually can be useful things to have in a program, especially when you're trying to construct programs that have to continue to do the right thing over a long period of time. So that included robots and thermostats and operating systems and video games. I ended up talking a bit about my own research field of reinforcement learning, where tasks are defined by specifying a reward function or a goal, and then the program actually gets to change its behavior to try to figure out how to satisfy the goal to make things work. So now we're getting even further away, and instead of programming the robot to do something, we program it to learn to do something, and then we stand back and give it the right experience so that it does what it has to do. So this could be a useful, if lots of people who don't know how to program, if this was a very commonplace thing that all our devices came with reinforcement learners, then maybe instead of programming your VCR, you would reward and punish your VCR and it would learn to do the right thing. And I gave some examples, brought in a robot, I showed some examples of what robots can do, and I pointed out that robots are basically computers that have things that connect into the real world. The last chapter was the Hillis's Flady chapter, which he called Beyond Engineering, where he talked about this idea that classical engineering methods, building pieces and then combining them together, can actually fail badly when you're talking about very big, very complex projects. He prefers this notion of a genetic algorithm that actually does more generate and test. Here's a solution, let's test it out. If it's good, you keep it. If it's bad, you throw it away and you replace it with combinations of things that seem to be good. So you end up using populations of individuals which may be represented by bits. And they're allowed to mate if their fitness is sufficiently high and they produce new generations of improved individuals. Even though maybe this isn't so useful to us, it did end up representing a nice summary of earlier concepts. You need random numbers and you need to sort and you need lots of if-then stuff. So lots of these ideas that we talked about through the semester all come into play to make these kinds of genetic algorithms. All right, so let's see. I forgot to turn this. So any questions on any of that? I'm gonna show my last music video of the semester, which is a little summary song about the class that I did last semester, and then we can talk about the sample final if you have questions on that. But before that, any questions on the summary? You good? I know I was talking fast. Wanted to kind of thought through it, make sure that you just kind of tickle your memories just so that you remember that we did cover all this stuff, even if not all of it is going to be represented on the final, it's still things you've been exposed to now. All right, so if we're good, it sounds like you're either asleep or fine with that, then I will try to remember how to turn the volume up. All right. Good night. Okay, all right, so what was the question here? Find a Huffman code for laugh football, laugh out loud football. Which I picked not because it's an actual word, but because we've been doing 11-letter sequences, and this was 11 letters, and it had a lot of repeats in it, so it made for an interesting code. If all 11 letters are distinct from each other, the code is really boring. So this seemed like it would be an interesting one. All right, so what do we do? All right, here are the steps. We have the word, and we're going to count up the number of times each letter appears in the word. So L, start with, we have one of those, L, O, L. F O O G B A A L L. All right, so we've got four L's, three O's, one F, one T, one B, one A. All right, so far so good. Okay, so now the process goes like this. We're going to build a tree from the bottom up, always merging the two smallest counts that we've got. Okay? If there's ties, it doesn't matter how we choose. So first thing we need to do is find the two smallest items in what we have. So I'll choose, I don't know, F and B. So we've got an F, there's one of those, and a B, there's one of those, and we're going to connect them together in a tree, and we don't need to worry about them anymore. So now, what have we got? Four L's, three O's, one T, one A, and two FBs. This is now a unit that has a count of two. So the next thing we do is we take the two smallest items and merge them together. So this is two, this is one, oh, but this is also one. So the two smallest are the two ones, the T and the A. All right? We can't merge into this two because we have things that are smaller than that, the T and the A. So if I do T and A, one each of those, T and A, we've now got, those went away, we now have this TA unit of two, an FB unit of two, an O unit of three, and an L unit of four. Okay? So now, what do we merge next? We need to merge the two smallest. So what would that be in this case? The O and either one of these guys. No. Because the O is three, this guy's two, and this guy's two. So the two smallest are the two twos. So we merge these two twos together to make a four. All right? So now we've got a 4, a 3, and a 4. Now we can merge a 3 together with either of the 4s. So we can do it this way. We'll merge. We have these two guys. We're going to merge them together and make a 7. They come off our list. And so now all that we've got left is this block of 7 and this block of 4. There isn't any choice anymore. We have to merge them together. We make a block of 11, and that's our tree. Yeah?
Can you merge the O with the 4?
Could I merge the O with this big block? Yes.
And then, so like that. So L would only be one bit, but I would have to come
with 4. Well, so what we can do, so now the question is, what do we get as our... So, you can make a code, but the question, in this case, the question is asking, and the final one looks just like this, except there's a different thing where it says LOL football, it's just something different. But the question is identical. It says, how many bits does it take to write this string in your code?
Would it have the same amount of bits both ways?
Yes. Yeah, that's the wicked cool thing about Huffman codes, that it finds the minimum. As long as you follow these rules, even if there's choices, you make arbitrary choices, when you're done, it's the minimum. You can get different codes out, but you always get the same total code length. Yeah.
The other left hand tree that you have in here, the number 11, that's okay. Like, it's still like Huffman code, you just have another.
So we can look at that one. So the way that I structured the final is there's 20 questions. The first 10 are really supposed to be on the second half of the semester. And then the last 10 are basically 5 from the first half and 5 from the second half. So, yeah, Huffman ended up being both in the summary for this half and in the summary for the whole class. So it showed up twice. This isn't quite, we didn't finish the answer. Does anyone want to see the rest of the way through to the answer on this one? Is that a yes? That's a yes hand. Okay, all right, sure. So just to kind of tie this off, now we need to know how many bits does it take to write down LOL football in the code that we created. So we need to make the code, but now we need to know how big it ends up being. So the way that I do this, you can actually just do it. You can say, well, the code, you know, zeros are left and ones are right. So you can say the code for A is 111, for example, and actually write out the whole LOL football. But usually what I do is take a shortcut. And the shortcut goes like this. There are four L's, and each one of them is 1-2 bits long. So 8 of the bits in the final answer are due to L's. There are 3 O's, and each one of them is 1-2 bits long. So 6 of the bits are due to O's. In my code, we can do the other code and see that it comes out the same. But let's just stick with this one for a moment. There's one F, and the F has 1, 2, 3 bits in it. So 3 of the bits in the final answer are due to F. There are one B, there is one B, and it's the number of bits in it, they're 1, 2, 3. There are one T's, is R1. And the number of bits in it is 1, 2, 3. So 3 of the bits in the answer are due to T. And the A is 1, 2, 3 bits long, and there's one A, so that's 3. So now what's our total? 8 plus 6 is 14, plus another 3 is 17, plus another 3 is 20, plus 3 is 23, plus 3 is 26. So LOL football ends up being 26 bits long in this code. Now what I'd like to do is actually, a question came up is, what if we had merged it differently? And let's see, we'll get a different code, but let's see if we get the same answer. So is that okay? Does anybody need this to be up a little longer? Can I do some tree surgery? There's tree surgeons, right? That's a job, isn't it? So the question was, what if we had at this stage, we have a 4-unit, a 3-unit, and a 4-unit, and we merged these two together, but we could have merged the 3 and this 4. It's still merging 3s and 4s. That would have given us 7 and 11. All right? So now what happens? Now, the code for L is 1 bit long. It's just 0. So 4 of the bits in the answer are due to L now. That's different than before. All right. The O's, there's 3 of them, and they're 2 bits long. 1, 2. So 6 of the bits in the answer, right? Each of the O's is 2 bits long, and there's 3 of them, so that's 6 bits in the answer that's from the O. The F now is 1, 2, 3, 4 bits. The B is 1, 2, 3, 4 bits. The T is 1, 2, 3, 4 bits. And the A is 1, 2, 3, 4 bits. So they all went up. So our L's got shorter, but our B, F, T, A's all get longer. So what's our total now? 10 plus 4 is 14, plus 4 is 18, plus 4 is 22, plus 4 is 26. So don't worry. As long as you always merge the two smallest items, the total size of your code will turn out to be the same, and you'll get the right answer. And, you know, I wouldn't mind at all if you actually drew the tree, because if you get the right answer, I'm just going to check it off. But if you get the wrong answer, I'm going to go looking to try to give you partial credit. I'm going to look through the tree. That's the time-consuming part for me, but it's, you know, an opportunity for you to make sure that if you made one small mistake and you end up with, like, Ari, when he did this problem, he got the answer as 24. That would be wrong, but if he had drawn the tree for me, I would have been able to see that probably what he did is he added the numbers and just got the wrong sum. So it was very small, it might have been a very small mistake. But I can't tell. If you just give me the answer, I won't be able to tell. All right, we okay? All right, so that's question 3. If you couldn't have done that before I did the explanation, I suggest that you still go through and do it. Because the one on the final is going to look just like it. And if you don't want to find out whether you understand it when you're sitting there next Wednesday. Yeah?
Before you're making the tree, I just 5 bits in the veil to be 3. And I did that for this and still left me 6, but that's a good coincidence.
Yes. Don't do that on the test. And again, it may work. And if you end up with the right answer and for that completely wrong reason, I might give you credit because you got the right answer. But chances are you won't get the right answer, and then it'll be for a bad reason. So yeah, this time, right, it didn't end up that way this time. The vowels, one of the vowels was 2 bits long, and one of the vowels was 4 bits long, and the consonants all varied. So yeah, you found a pattern, but it's not a consistent pattern. All right, so ready to move on to number 3. We'll go to number 7. And sometime either tonight or tomorrow, tonight, or maybe tomorrow morning, I'll email out the answers to all the questions along with my own explanations. But I'll make the explanations more complete if I know which questions feel sticky or difficult. All right. Oh, good. All right, so number 7. This is a different kind of looping than we looked at before. So these are nested loops. A nested loop is a loop inside another loop. And there was a question that had a nested loop on the midterm, but I realized that I had never really properly introduced you. So class, this is a nested loop. Nested loop, this is the class. All right, so what do these nested loops do? So let's... Maybe we can fire up Scratch and actually check this out. Go Scratch. Where is my Scratch? All right, so we're going to make a script that looks like the ones that we've got there. And it's going to have a nested loop in it. In this case, a nested repeat loop. All right. So here's our nested repeat loop. So let's do this piecemeal. So let's look at the inside of the loop first. What happens if I do this? Okay, that's not what I was expecting. Oh, I know why. Does anybody know why?
Does them both really quickly?
It did them both really quickly. So I didn't put a weight on the end of it, and so it did one pop and the other pop, and to our ears it sounded like one. But if it pops and then waits, we should be able to hear 2 pops, okay? So this little piece of code that you see right here makes 2 pops. If you think of it as a unit, this is this reduction idea again. If you think of it as one thing, and what it does is make 2 pops, what happens if we put it inside this loop and it gets repeated 3 times? So the first time, it does 2 pops. And the second time, it does 2 pops. And the third time, it does 2 pops. So, six. Why 6? Because it's repeating 2 pops 3 times, and 2 times 3 is 6. Okay? So this is sort of a neat thing. You know, multiplication does not, this isn't about multiplication, but it turns out to basically reduce to it. So, there's no questions here, right? If I change that to a 10, you're all good with where that's going to go now? That's going to be 30 pops? I won't do 30 pops. But now, what if we do this? That's not what I meant. I don't want a variable called 4. That would be very confusing, wouldn't it?
Express that you do that?
Yeah, it seemed perfectly fine with it. we'll call it x. And we'll set x to 4. That's what I meant. All right, so now... All right, so let's take a look at this. What's going to happen now? So it's going to repeat 3 times a loop, and that loop is going to repeat x times a pop. So x in this case is 4, so this piece here is going to pop 4 times, and that's going to be, that whole thing is going to repeat 3 times. So 4 times 3 is 12, so it's going to be 12. It's not 4 plus 3, right? It's not, there is a different loop that we could do. This is plus, right? First do three pops, then do four pops. So it'll do a total of seven. Okay? This says each time, for three times, repeat, do four pops. So for each of three, do four. So that's going to multiply. That's going to be 12. So, any questions on that? We good? So now I'm going to take this idea and bring it back to the question from the sample final. So, it's not popping now. It's changing total by one. So let's, maybe I should do that. Maybe that's more concrete. So we'll make a variable called total. And we're going to start off with total at zero. Just doesn't want to click. There it goes. All right, so we're going to change total by one. All right, so what is this going to do? Now instead of popping, each time it hits that line where it's going to pop, it's going to add one to the total. The total starts at a zero, so what should happen here is, notice, see total? It counted up to 12. Okay, it started at a zero, and then each time it went through the loop, it added one to that. So when all is said and done, I can slow it down for you. That's not easy to see. That was in some ways distracting because it popped at the wrong time. So. All right. So it just counted the pops. So now we'll go back to here. We set total to zero, and we repeat four times a loop that says repeat n times, change total up by one. What's going to happen is it's going to make total. Well, what if n was 3? Then it would add. Then total would end up being 12. If n was 10, then total would end up being 20. No, sorry, 40. In general, this piece of code, if you don't know what n is, total is going to end up being 4 times whatever n is, or 4n. Okay? So the answer I'm looking at for this first, looking for in this first one is 4n. Any questions on that? If not, I'm going to move to the second one and let you think about that one. So do you get why it's 4n? Because when you nest loops, it basically you're multiplying together how many times the inside of the inner loop is executed. And in this case, what the inner loop, the inside of the loop does is it adds one to the count. So it's basically saying, how many times am I going to go through these loops? And the answer is 4 times n. So the second one, what's that going to be? There's an outer loop that is repeated a times, whatever a is, and an inner loop that's repeated b times, whatever b is. And so I think we can assume that they're both positive numbers. So what does total end up being by the end of that? A times B. Good. All right. And the last one, I probably should have done a first one that was just numbers, but this one's got n's and numbers in it. So the outer loop is repeated whatever n is minus 3. The inner loop is repeated 7 times, and again, it's just changing total up by 1 each time. So when all is said and done, total is going to be increased. It's going to end up with 7 times n minus 3. Right? Or 7n minus 21. Yeah?
For something like that, does it matter whether we write 7 times n minus 3 or if you want us to have 7n minus 21?
I'd rather it in lowest terms, but this isn't really a class about reducing things to lowest terms. So I might ding you one point, but, you know. Because certainly you could also write it as, you know, n plus n plus n plus n plus. At some point, I'm going to get irritated. So just make it as simple as you can, but don't make yourself crazy about it. The one on the final isn't really any more complicated than that.
So we'll just be in 7 parentheses.
No, I'd rather you actually multiply it through. My preference would be 7n minus 21 as the answer, but if you put 7 times n minus 3, make sure the parentheses are there, I may take off one point. Maybe not even. Okay? All right, so that was loop in number 7. I don't know, I wanted to make some kind of joke about Remus Lupin, but it just, I just left it this way. I thought, Lupin, because it's got the N, Lupin. All right, if we're good up to this point, then I'm on to number 11. Okay. What is the 6-letter magic word? It's actually 2 words. Just use the first. What was that? What was it? I don't see the lips moving, but I hear the words.
Who's saying?
Peanut butter was the, that was for the sample final, that was the magic word, but I wanted just a 6-letter word, so we'll just take the peanut. So the answer to the first part would be peanut. Part B says, use the tree on the next page to find a Huffman encoding for the word. If you don't know the word, just use the word please. So basically, if you don't know the magic word, then you don't. It's not like you can't do the question at all. It just means you'll just lose points for not knowing the magic word. You can use the substitute. So let's go and encode please using this tree. Or we could do peanut, I guess, because we all know it now. It's a different word for the actual final. It was mentioned in class. If you weren't here in class, then it would be on the podcast. All right, so this is a tree that I made, and we're trying to encode, what, peanut? So what do? We just do it 1 letter at a time. First we do the P, and the P is 1011. Then we do the E is 11. Then we do the A is 010. Then we do the N, and is 011. Then we do the U, 10011. 10011. And then we do the T, 1010. So that's peanut in the Huffman encoding that tree represents. On the final, I used the exact same tree, but you have to encode a different word. All right, we good?
Oh, so we're going to be using the tree you made?
Yes. Okay. I made the tree, and in fact, this is the tree that's on the file. You can memorize this code, though, and there's really no, I don't think that will help anything. But you could write, if you wanted to prepare, look, you could write out underneath the S, the code for S, of course, is 00. So you could just write that down, it's kind of a shortcut. But you should be able to figure out the code for any letter, you just follow down from the root. So, C is 10000. That gets you to the C. And then the encoding of the word is just, you just string all the bits together. We can go in the other direction, right? We can actually take this sequence. If I didn't know it was peanut. Well, actually, I guess the other question is, that's the next question. So let's do that. What does... One, zero, how many zeros is that?
1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay, 1 followed by 2 zeros, 3 ones, and then 010. What does that spell in the Huffman coding on the next page? Well, since we know that the codes are made by going down from the root, we start at the root and we say 1, okay, that takes us to the right root branch. Then it's 0, that's left from there. 0, left from there. 0, left from there. 0, left from there. So this, I think, is C, right? The 1 followed by 4 zeros should be a C. 1, 2, 3, 4. All right, so that gets us C. And now we're back up to the top for the next letter. 1, 0, 0, 1, 1. 10011, that's U. And then we've got 1010, that's a T. It's the word cut. Who would have guessed? It doesn't look like the word cut. Anyway, there it is. The C was the longest of them. No, I guess a bunch of them were long. So any sequence of bits is going to turn into some sequence of those letters. Sanj Dup Kud. Okay? Is that, yes?
Are you going to go to the next, question, or are you still going to?
I feel like I'm done question number 11 now.
Okay.
But if you have more questions about question number 11, this would be a good time to ask. Are we done with 11? No, wait, you want to go on to something else. Anybody have any more questions about this number 11? Yeah?
Wait, how did you get the potential for peanut?
Right, so I said it in class.
Okay.
So the people who were here heard it, the people who weren't here heard it on the podcast. Except for the people who didn't listen to the podcast. They wouldn't have any way of knowing at all. All right, that was number 11. And there's the same, yeah, the one on the final looks just like the same tree, same question. It just so happened that the magic word that the class picked was also six letters. You want to encode that. If you don't remember that, if you didn't have the magic word handy, then you need to. I'll tell you what the word to do instead. It won't be please, but it'll be something else. And then I give you another bit sequence and say what does it spell. So that's what number 11 looks like.
Do you know the magic word already for the final?
People who were there when I announced it know it. People who weren't here and heard it on the podcast would know it. People who neither came to lecture nor listened to the podcast probably don't know it. I didn't say that, but it does seem like a really good idea. Yes. Yes, good question. All right, next one to look at. I can tell you exactly where on the podcast. In fact, why don't I just tell you the magic word? Anyway, did you have another question that you wanted to do?
Yeah, number 6.
I mean, you could pay people who are here if you really want to. All right, number 6. Oh, number 6. All right. Whoa. I didn't say right now. You're thwarting me, people. All right, so, all right. Mystery routines. The scratch-like scripts below work on the 1 through n elements of list L and set the variable answer to 0, meaning false, or 1, meaning true. Match each script to the question it answers. So what you need to do is there's 3 descriptions and there's 3 scripts and each one matches 1. So like A might be mystery 2 and B might be mystery 1 and C might be mystery 3. But what we have to do is figure out which one is which. All right, so how are we going to do this? So let's look at the first script and see if we can say in words what it's going to do. They all have the same structure. And in fact, I made all the ones on the final also have the same structure. So once you understand the structure, it should be relatively straightforward. So let's look at mystery 1. It says repeat. We start off with some number n. Repeat until that number gets less than 1. And what we're going to repeat is some if statement, some question about it. And what we're asking is, if the nth element of the list, L bracket n, is less than 10, then what you do is you set answer to 0 and you're done. So basically it says, if the nth element of the list is a number that's smaller than 10, then the answer to this whole question is no. Otherwise, it changes n by minus 1. It looks at the next element of the list. I'm standing on the chair and yet I'm still just waving my hand around. I don't know why this is helping. So now it goes to the next element in the list. And it's just going to keep doing that loop until one of two things happens. Either it hits an element in the loop where the list element is less than 10, in which case it says the answer is no, or it makes it all the way through the list and never finds a number that's smaller than 10, in which case it sets the answer to 1 or true and stops the script. So it's when is it going to say yes and when is it going to say no? It's going to say no if there's an element in the list that's less than 10. It's going to say yes in the other case, if all the elements in the list are bigger than or equal to 10. All right? Does that, yeah?
Then what's the change n by -1?
That's just taking us through the list backwards. So we start off pointing at the last element of the list, and each time we go through this loop, we bump and we look at the one before it. So basically, if you think about a list of numbers like, 3, 15, 7, 6, 2. Right? So initially, n is telling us the last element of the list. Or n is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. N is 5. And L bracket N bracket is the fifth element of the list. So it's N is sort of pointing to this guy. And we say, is it less than, I made it too easy. Is it less than 10? The answer is yes, it is less than 10. So it sets the answer to 0 and it quits. But if this were 12 and this were 16 and this were 17, then what it's going to do is the if statement will be not executed, right? It's going to say, if the number we're looking at is less than 10, it's not less than 10. So it won't do the inside of the script, inside of that if statement. Instead, it's just going to make n one smaller. So n is going to now indicate one more up in the list. And it's going to keep scanning until it actually hits the end of the list, at which point n itself is less than 1, so it will stop and do whatever's at the bottom of the loop. Yeah?
So you don't really understand the script. You just look at the if and then compare it to the what.
That would be it, yes. Because they're all the same, you could take that shortcut. Yes. Yeah, but really what it's doing is, what test is it running on each element of the list? So yeah, the if statement is the test that's being run on each element of the list. You also need to know whether it sets answer to 0 or inside the, there, or 1 inside there. It ends up being, that changes things. So, but for this one, it's saying, I'm going to set the answer to 0 if I ever find a list element that's less than 10, otherwise I'm going to set it to 1. So let's look at this list here. Choice B is, are all the elements in the list 10 or larger? And that's what this was doing. Basically, if everything in the list was 10 or larger, the if statement would have failed every single time, and it would have returned true. If there was something in the list that was less than 10, it would have returned 0. It would have been no. Are all elements in the list 10 or larger? No. So yeah. So the condition in the if statement is really the critical piece here. So let's look at mystery 2. So mystery B is mystery 1. What's mystery 2? Mystery 2 says, again, we're going to go through the list backwards, and we're going to ask, is the current element of the list that we're looking at equal to minus 1? If it is, set the answer to true. If it's not, keep going. And if we get all the way to the end, and we never found one that's negative 1, then we return false. Yes?
Just out of curiosity, does scratch start with a 0 element?
Scratch? Notice I have Scratch-like scripts. Scratch doesn't have any arrays at all.
Okay.
Yeah. So some languages start their arrays at 0. Some of them start at 1. Scratch doesn't start them at all. So let's just say that it starts at 1. That's what all these examples do. Anyway, so what this is asking is, for each one it asks, hey, are you minus 1? You are. Good. Then my answer is yes. On the other hand, if it makes it all the way through the list and it's never done that, then it says, oh, my answer is no. So if you look at that, it's really answering the question, does the number minus 1 appear in the list? Right? If not, minus 1 appears in the list, then at some point walking through the list, we'd encounter minus 1, and we'd say, oh, yes, we're done. We found it. Otherwise, it'll keep looking through the list. It'll never see it. The loop will end. It'll say, oh, I guess there wasn't a minus 1. I didn't see him while I was walking down the street.
Oh, wait.
What's that?
Into the program?
No. I don't understand the question.
Were they trying to figure out the answer?
What I'm suggesting that you do is you kind of step through the script and you look at the condition that it's testing in the if. Well, I missed. But you know, well, let's look at the next one. That one. Yeah. So that one's asking, I'm looking at the nth element in the list. Is that element equal to n? In other words, is it the case that the number that appears in the nth position is equal to n? And if the answer is yes, then it says, the script stops and says yes. Otherwise, if it never finds such a number, it returns no. And you'll see that actually matches the description for C. Is there an element in the list whose position matches the number, like the number 5 in the fifth position?
Okay, so we're matching the description.
Right. So your answer is, the correct answer to this would be A is mystery 2, B is mystery 1, and C is mystery 3.
Okay.
And that would be full credit. Okay? It looks like we're kind of reaching the end of our block here. Oh, we've got 5, so people need to go, you need to go, but we still have 5 more minutes of class, so I'll continue to answer questions.
What is the 5?
What's that?
What day is the 5?
It's a week from today. It's Wednesday at noon. Does that agree with everybody?
Yeah.
Wednesday at noon. See you then.
Yes,
you're right here. Same bat time. No. Same bat time. Not same bat time. Yes. Yes, everything's open.
Open notebook?
What?
It's an open notebook.
Open notebook, yes. You can bring the sample answers to the sample final. You can bring that. That will help someone. I recommend you do so. Yes? Yeah, well, I mean, what's easiest for me to, so I can grade fast is tell me the answer. If it's correct, I'm just going to move on. If it's incorrect, then I'm going to go sifting for clues. So make it easy for me to find what your final answer is, and then make it easy for me to figure out how you got that.
Oh, no, I meant when you're doing the...
When I send my sample answer, I will put I have some description explaining how I got the answer. But if you want more, please let me know, because that's how you'll understand it. I'm not officially done yet, so if there's another question, I'll continue to get it. Yeah.
Figure out 9.
Number 9?
Are you 2 for 3?
Good, all right. So is the product of these numbers divisible by 5? So how can you figure that out? So if the product would be divisible by 5, if there's a factor of 5 in the answer, that would also be the case. The only way that can be the case is if there's a factor of 5 in one of those things you're multiplying together. And that you can tell really quickly, because a number that has a 0 or a 5 at the end is divisible by 5. All you have to do is, if there's anything, look at the second element in the list. It's 230. It has a factor of 5 in it. When you multiply them all together, it'll still have that factor of 5 in it. So the answer will be yes. The only way the answer is no is if you go all the way through this thing and there's no numbers that end in 0 or 5. I'm hoping that some people don't answer this question and they look at this and they're like, oh, they type all these numbers into their calculator, which I hope makes their calculator go up, because it's much easier.
Well, what about, can you tell them?
It's harder with other. No, but if you're saying the one in the final is going to be 5. But just to answer the question, if you want to know if the product is divisible by 7, you still don't have to multiply them all together. All you have to do is check if any of them are divisible by 7. The easy way to do that is divide each one of them by 7 and see if you get it wrong. Yeah. 12. Did you want the rest of 9? Did you want B? It'll be in this. I think it's pretty well explained in the sample answer. So if you stump on it, sorry, what did 12 say? I'm happy to answer it, but it's not the easiest one to do fast. The trick was, just remember the trick from class. What you do is you go, we've got 3 variables of input, A, B, and C, and 1 variable of output, squat looking D. You go through the outputs and find all the lines that have true for the output. So in this case, it's the false, true, false line, the false, true, true line, and the true, true, true line. And each of those becomes, we're going to end up ORing them together. So it looks like this. Not A, and B, and not C. That's that first true line, right? That's it. That's
B. That exactly.
No.
Not A and B or C.
Not A and B or C. Well, what I'm suggesting is that may be the final answer, but not. No. The only way to get that one line that has a true, the first one that has a true in it, is that line is specified by not A and B and not C. That's that line in the table.
If you get or C, isn't it so false? Oh, never mind. Yeah, I'm sorry.
We're going to OR together all the lines that are true. Okay. So then we have not A and B and C, or the third line that's true is A and B and C. Now, it turns out in this case, you can actually simplify this expression. This expression will get you 9 out of the 10 points. You can actually simplify it. It turns out that it's actually something like A and B or C, or A and not B or C. I'll send it in the sample answer, but that'll get you the full 10. There's certain things. So the B, you can factor the B out. So it's actually B and not A or C. That's the full credit version. And you'll see, if you look at that expression, it actually matches up perfectly. Yeah?
I feel like I remember when we learned learned is you actually told us to find out what the most answer was like. Because
right, if there was a lot more trues than falses, then you want to do it in the negated form.
But you just want us to do the trues.
I think the one that I did, well, in this case, there were fewer trues than falses, so this was the right way to do it. What, I forget if it was the one on the final. Again, if you give an expression that's correct, you're going to get most of the credit. If you give an expression that's correct and as small as possible, then you get full credit. Yeah?
Number 13, how do you want us to answer the question like in what? For specifically for B, like, do you want it to be like,
No. The answer is either 1 or 2.
I'm sorry. I did the wrong one.
Yes, my mistake.
It's up for number 10.
10?
Yeah. That's the look it up one,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. So A, what's A? Do you know A?
Is it a quick summary?
No. Using a solution of one problem to solve another is an example of. What is it? No, it's not the algorithm. Just in general, when you use one thing to find another one. It's the word that I've used the most in the whole class. Reduction. Yeah. B says if you use selection sort to do the sorting, what's the running time? Big O n squared.
Okay, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Like,
B is just wrote big O per n and superscript per n. If it were a different algorithm, you might use a different running time.
Are you on office hours?
I wasn't planning on it, but if you send me mail and I'm around and I can make the schedules work, I'd be happy to talk. Yeah. I've been hanging out on the chat room, but nobody's been chatting. But I assume that will increase exponentially as. Yeah.
Could you just go over B and B for number 8?
For number 8?
Yeah.
Are there two numbers listed add up to 1,000? Unsorted, you have to try all pairs. It's big O n squared.
Okay.
If it's sorted, it turns out you can kind of work in from the outside, and it ends up being big O of n. I said it once in class, but the algorithm actually is sort of tricky, so that won't be on the final.
Okay.
And which one's C?
D.
D is the product of the numbers 2 plus 7. You can just loop through the list and check if each one is divisible by 7, yes or no. So it's big O of n. Having it sorted doesn't help with that.
Okay.
So they're both big O of n.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. All right, I'm going to call this the official end of that. And other questions, please send by email. I'll send sample answers tonight, so you'll be able to look at them and say, what? And then we'll get it all figured out before the final.
Are you doing extra credit on the black hat?
I guess not really. I made a couple of the questions I thought really easy and hoping that they'd be gimmicks for people. But no, there's no additional credit. I just ran out of steam and coming up with questions. Sure. Green. We're going to need first. And if it works for me, then we'll try you. If it doesn't work for you, then we'll